Introduction to Bound. In 1978, the Penthouse people were planning to put out a magazine that would feature futurism and science fiction. The magazine was to be called Omni. They asked me for a story for the first issue and offered me generous payment. I was in a quandary. By the terms of my agreement with Joel Davis, the genial publisher of Asimov, I had to give that magazine the refusal on any of my science fiction, which is, after all, only right. So I put it up to Joel, asking if I might have permission to do a science fiction story for Omni this one time, and explaining that if he said no, it was no, and there would be no argument. As it happens, however, Joel never tries to get in the way of my earning a living. He suggested that Omni give him favorable terms for a one-shot advertisement of Asimov in the magazine, and Omni was perfectly willing. Therefore, with cooperation and good humor all around, I wrote Found, and it appeared in the very first issue, November 1978, of Omni, which has since gone on to score a considerable success. No, I don't think that was because of my story either. Story 7. Found. Computer 2, like the other three that chased each other's tails in orbit round the Earth, was much larger than it had to be. It might have been one-tenth its diameter, and yet contained all the volume it needed to store the accumulated and accumulating data needed to control spaceflight. They needed the extra space, however, so that Joe and I could get inside if we had to. And we had to. Computer 2 was perfectly capable of taking care of itself. Ordinarily, that is. It was redundant. It worked everything out three times in parallel, and all three programs had to mesh perfectly. All three answers had to match. If they did not, the answer was delayed for nanoseconds while Computer 2 checked itself, found a malfunctioning part, and replaced it. There was no sure way in which ordinary people would know how many times it caught itself. Perhaps never. Perhaps twice a day. Only Computer Central could measure the time delay induced by error, and only Computer Central knew how many of the component spares had been used as replacements. And Computer Central never talked about it. The only good public image is perfection. And for all practical purposes, it's been perfection, for there was never any call for Joe and me. We're the troubleshooters. We go up there when something really goes wrong, and Computer 2 or one of the others can't correct itself. It's never happened in the 5 years we've been on the job. It did happen now and again in the early days of their existence, but that was before our time. We keep in practice. Don't get me wrong. There isn't a computer made that Joe and I can't diagnose. Show us the error, and we'll show you the malfunction. Or Joe will, anyway. I'm not the kind who sings one's own praises. Anyway, this time, neither of us could make the diagnosis. The first thing that happened was that Computer 2 lost internal pressure. That's not unprecedented, and it's certainly not fatal. Computer 2 can work in a vacuum, after all. An internal atmosphere was established in the old days when it was expected there would be a steady flow of repairmen fiddling with it, and it's been kept up out of tradition. Who told you scientists aren't chained by tradition? In their spare time from being scientists, they're human, too. From the rate of pressure loss, it was deduced that a gravel-sized meteoroid had hit Computer 2. Its exact radius, mass, and energy was reported by Computer 2 itself, using that rate of pressure loss, and a few other things, as data. The second thing that happened was that the break was not sealed, and the atmosphere was not regenerated. After that came the errors, and they called us in. It made no sense. Joe let a look of pain cross his homely face and said, "There must be a dozen things out of whack." Someone at Computer Central said, "The hunk of gravel ricocheted, very likely." Joe said, "With that energy of entry, it would have passed right through the other side. No ricochets. Besides, even with ricochets, I figure it would have had to take some very unlikely strikes." "Well, then, what do we do?" Joe looked uncomfortable. I think that it was at this point that he realized what was coming. He had made it sound peculiar enough to require the troubleshooters on the spot, and Joe had never been up in space. If he had told me once that his chief reason for taking the job was that he knew it meant he would never have to go up in space, he had told it to me 2 to the x power times, with x a pretty high number. So I said it for him. I said, "We'll have to go up there." Joe's only way out would have been to say he didn't think he could handle the job, and I watched his pride slowly come out ahead of his cowardice. Not by much, you understand. By a nose, let's say. To those of you who haven't been on a spaceship in the last 15 years, and I suppose Joe can't be the only one, let me emphasize that the initial acceleration is the only troublesome thing. You can't get away from that, of course. After that, it's nothing, unless you want to count possible boredom. You're just a spectator. The whole thing is automated and computerized. The old romantic days of space pilots are gone totally. I imagine they'll return briefly when our space settlements make the shift to the asteroid belt, as they constantly threaten to do, but then only until additional computers are placed in orbit to set up the necessary additional capacity. Joe held his breath throughout the acceleration, or at least he seemed to. I must admit that I wasn't very comfortable myself. It was only my third trip. I've taken a couple of vacations on Settlement Row with my husband, but I'm not exactly a seasoned hand. After that, he was relieved for a while, but only for a while. He got despondent. "I hope this thing knows where it's going," he said pettishly. I extended my arms forward, palms up, and felt the rest of me sway backward a bit in the zero-gravity field. "You," I said, "are a computer specialist. Don't you know it knows?" "Sure, but Computer 2 is off." "We're not hooked into Computer 2," I said. "There are 3 others, and even if only one were left functional, it could handle all the space flights undertaken on an average day." "All 4 might go off. If Computer 2 is wrong, what's to stop the rest?" "Then we'll run this thing manually." "You'll do it, I suppose. You know how? I think not." "So they'll talk me in." "For the love of ENIAC," he groaned. There was no problem, actually. We moved out to Computer 2 as smooth as vacuum, and less than 2 days after takeoff, we were placed into a parking orbit not 10 meters behind it. What was not so smooth was that, about 20 hours out, we got the news from Earth that Computer 3 was losing internal pressure. Whatever had hit Computer 2 was going to get the rest, and when all 4 were out, spaceflight would grind to a halt. It could be reorganized on a manual basis, surely, but that would take months as a minimum, possibly years, and there would be serious economic dislocation on Earth. Worse yet, several thousand people now out in space would surely die. It wouldn't bear thinking of, and neither Joe nor I talked about it. But it didn't make Joe's disposition sweeter, and let's face it, it didn't make me any happier. Earth hung over 200,000 kilometers below us. But Joe didn't seem to be bothered by that. He was concentrating on his tether, and was checking the cartridge in his reaction gun. He wanted to make sure he could get to Computer 2 and back again. You'd be surprised, if you've never tried it, how you can get your space legs if you absolutely have to. I wouldn't say there was nothing to it, and we did waste half the fuel we used, but we finally reached Computer 2. We hardly made any bump at all when we struck Computer 2. You hear it, of course, even in vacuum, because the vibration travels through the metalloid fabric of your spacesuit. But there was hardly any bump, just a whisper. Of course, our contact and the addition of our momentum altered the orbit of Computer 2 slightly, but tiny expenditures of fuel compensated for that, and we didn't have to worry about it. Computer 2 took care of it, for nothing had gone wrong with it, as far as we could tell, that affected any of its external workings. We went over the outside first, naturally. The chances were pretty overwhelming that a small piece of gravel had whizzed through Computer 2, and that would leave an unmistakable ragged hole. 2 of them, in all probability, one going in and one coming out. Chances of that happening are 1 in 2 million on any given day. Even money that it will happen at least once in 6,000 years. It's not likely, but it can, you know. The chances are one in not more than 10 billion that on any one day, it will be struck by a meteoroid large enough to demolish it. I didn't mention that, because Joe might realize that we were exposed to similar odds ourselves. In fact, any given strike on us would do far more damage to our soft and tender bodies than to the stoical and much-enduring machinery of the computer. And I didn't want Joe more nervous than he was. The thing is, though, it wasn't a meteoroid. "What's this?" said Joe, finally. It was a small cylinder, stuck to the outer wall of computer 2, the first abnormality we had found in its outward appearance. It was about half a centimeter in diameter, and perhaps 6 centimeters long, just about cigarette size, for any of you who've been caught up in the antique fad of smoking. We brought our small flashlights into play. I said, "That's not one of the external components." "It sure isn't," muttered Joe. There was a faint spiral marking running round the cylinder from one end to the other. Nothing else. For the rest, it was clearly metal, but of an odd, grainy texture, at least to the eye. Joe said, "It's not tight." He touched it gently with a fat and gauntleted finger, and it gave. Where it had made contact with the surface of computer 2, it lifted, and our flashes shone down on a visible gap. "There's the reason gas pressure inside declined to zero," I said. Joe grunted. He pushed a little harder, and the cylinder dropped away and began to drift. We managed to snare it after a little trouble. Left behind was a perfectly round hole in the skin of computer 2, half a centimeter across. Joe said, "This thing, whatever it is, isn't much more than foil." It gave easily under his fingers, thin but springy. A little extra pressure and it dented. He put it inside his pouch, which he snapped shut, and said, "Go over the outside and see if there are any other items like that anywhere on it. I'll go inside." It didn't take me very long. Then I went in. "It's clean," I said. "That's the only thing there is, the only hole." "One is enough," said Joe gloomily. He looked at the smooth aluminum of the wall, and in the light of the flash, the perfect circle of black was beautifully evident. It wasn't difficult to place a seal over the hole. It was a little more difficult to reconstitute the atmosphere. Computer 2's reserve gas plumbing supplies were low, and the controls required manual adjustment. The solar generator was limping, but we managed to get the lights on. Eventually, we removed our gauntlets and helmet, but Joe carefully placed the gauntlets inside his helmet and secured them both to one of his suit loops. "I want these handy if the air pressure begins to drop," he said sourly. So I did the same. No use being devil-may-care. There was a mark on the wall just next to the hole. I had noted it in the light of my flash when I was adjusting the seal. When the lights came on, it was obvious. "You notice that, Joe?" I said. "I noticed." There was a slight narrow depression in the wall, not very noticeable at all, but it was there beyond doubt if you ran your finger over it, and it continued for nearly a meter. It was as though someone had scooped out a very shallow sampling of the metal, and the surface where that had taken place was distinctly less smooth than elsewhere. I said, "We'd better call Computer Central downstairs." "If you mean back on Earth, say so," said Joe. "I hate that phony space talk. In fact, I hate everything about space. That's why I took an Earthside job. I mean, a job on Earth. Or what was supposed to be one." I said patiently, "We'd better call Computer Central back on Earth."
"What for?"
"To tell them we found the trouble."
"Oh? What did we find?"
"The hole, remember?"
"Oddly enough, I do."
"And what caused the hole? It wasn't a meteoroid. I never saw one that would leave a perfectly circular hole with no signs of buckling or melting, and I never saw one that left a cylinder behind." He took the cylinder out of his suit pocket and smoothed the dent out of its thin metal thoughtfully. "Well, what caused the hole?" I didn't hesitate. I said, "I don't know."
If we report to Computer Central, they'll ask the question and we'll say, we don't know. And what will we have gained? Except hassle. They'll call us, Joe, if we don't call them.
Sure.
And we won't answer, will we?
They'll assume something killed us, Joe, and they'll send up a relief party.
You know Computer Central. It will take them at least 2 days to decide on that. We'll have something before then, and once we have something, we'll call them. The internal structure of Computer 2 was not really designed for human occupancy. What was foreseen and allowed for was the occasional and temporary presence of troubleshooters. That meant there was room for maneuvering, and there were tools and supplies. There weren't any armchairs, though. For that matter, there was no gravitational field either, or any centrifugal imitation of one. We both floated in midair, drifting very slowly this way or that. Occasionally, one of us touched the wall and rebounded very slowly, or else part of one of us overlapped part of the other.
"Keep your foot out of my mouth," said Joe, and pushed it away violently.
It was a mistake, because we both began to turn. Of course, that's not how it looked to us. To us, it was the interior of Computer 2 that was turning, which was most unpleasant, and it took us a while to get relatively motionless again. We had the theory perfectly worked out in our Earthside training, but we were short on practice, a lot short. By the time we had steadied ourselves, I felt unpleasantly nauseated. You can call it nausea, or astronausea, or space sickness, but whatever you call it, it's the heaves. And it's worse in space than anywhere else because there's nothing to pull the stuff down. It floats around in a cloud of globules, and you don't want to be floating around with it. So I held it back, and so did Joe. I said, "Joe, it's clearly the computer that's at fault. Let's get at its insides." Anything to get my mind off my insides and let them quiet down. Besides, things weren't moving fast enough. I kept thinking of Computer 3 on its way down the tube. Maybe Computers 1 and 4 by now, too, and thousands of people in space with their lives hanging on what we could do. Joe looked a little greenish, too, but he said, "First, I've got to think." Something got in. It wasn't a meteoroid, because whatever it was chewed a neat hole out of the hull. It wasn't cut out, because I didn't find a circle of metal anywhere inside here. Did you?
No, but it hadn't occurred to me to look.
I looked, and it's nowhere in here.
It may have fallen outside.
With the cylinder covering the hole till I pulled it away? A likely thing. Did you see anything come flying out?
No.
Joe said, "We may still find it in here, of course, but I doubt it. It was somehow dissolved, and something got in."
What something?
Whose is it?
Joe's grin was remarkably ill-natured.
Why do you bother asking questions to which there is no answer? If this was last century, I'd say the Russians had somehow stuck that device onto the outside of Computer 2.
No offense.
If it were last century, you'd say it was the Americans.
I decided to be offended. I said coldly, "Be trying to say something that makes sense this century, Yosef."
Giving it an exaggerated Russian pronunciation. "We'll have to assume some dissident group. If so," I said, "we'll have to assume one with a capacity for spaceflight and with the ability to come up with an unusual device."
Joe said, "Spaceflight presents no difficulties if you can tap into the orbiting computers illegally, which has been done. As for the cylinder, that may make more sense when it is analyzed back on Earth. Downstairs, as you space buffs would say."
"It doesn't make sense," I said. "Where's the point in trying to disable Computer 2?
"As part of a program to cripple spaceflight."
"Then everyone suffers. The dissidents, too."
"But it gets everyone's attention, doesn't it? And suddenly the cause of whatever it is makes news.
Or the plan is to just knock out Computer 2. And then threaten to knock out the other three. No real damage, but lots of potential and lots of publicity." I don't believe it, I said. It's too dramatic. On the contrary, said Joe, I'm trying to be non-dramatic. He was studying all parts of the interior closely, edging over it square centimeter by square centimeter. I might suppose the thing was of non-human origin. Don't be silly. You want me to make the case? The cylinder made contact, after which something inside ate away a circle of metal and entered computer 2. It crawled over the inside wall, eating away a thin layer of metal for some reason. Does that sound like anything of human construction? Not that I know of, but I don't know everything. Even you don't know everything. Joe ignored that. So, the question is, how did it, whatever it is, get into the computer, which is, after all, reasonably well sealed? It did so quickly, since it knocked out the resealing and air regeneration capacities almost at once. Is that what you're looking for? I said, pointing. He tried to stop too quickly and somersaulted backward, crying, That's it! That's it! In his excitement, he was thrashing his arms and legs, which got him nowhere, of course. I grabbed him, and for a while we were both trying to exert pushes in uncoordinated directions, and that got us nowhere either. Joe called me a few names, but I called him some back, and I had the advantage of him there. I understand English perfectly, better than he does, in fact, but his knowledge of Russian is, well, fragmentary would be a kind way of putting it. Bad language in an ununderstood language always sounds very dramatic. Here it is, he said, when we had finally sorted ourselves out. Where the computer shielding met the wall, there was a small circular hole left behind when Joe brushed aside a small cylinder. It was just like the one on the outer hull, but it seemed even thinner. In fact, it seemed to disintegrate when Joe touched it. We'd better get into the computer, said Joe. The computer was a shamble. Not obviously, I don't mean to say it was like a beam of wood that had been riddled by termites. In fact, if you looked at the computer casually, you might swear it was intact. Look closely, though, and some of the chips would be gone. The more closely you looked, the more you realized were gone. Worse yet, the stores which Computer 2 used in self-repair had dwindled to almost nothing. We kept looking, and every once in a while, one of us would discover something else was missing. Joe took the cylinder out of his pouch again and turned it end for end. He said, I suspect it's after high-grade silicon in particular. I can't say for sure, of course, but my guess is that the sides are mostly aluminum, but that the flat end is mostly silicon. I said, do you mean the thing is a solar battery? Part of it is. That's how it gets its energy in space. Energy to get to computer 2. Energy to eat a hole into it. Energy to... I don't know how else to put it. Energy to stay alive. You call it alive? Why not? Look, computer 2 can repair itself. It can reject faulty bits of equipment and replace it with working ones, but it needs a supply of spares to work with. Given enough spares of all kinds, it could build a computer just like itself, when properly programmed. But it needs a supply so we don't think of it as alive. This object that entered computer 2 is apparently collecting its own supplies. That's suspiciously lifelike. What you're saying, I said, is that we have here a microcomputer advanced enough to be considered alive. I don't honestly know what I'm saying, said Joe. Who on earth could make such a thing? Who on earth? I made the next discovery. It looked like a stubby pen drifting through the air. I just caught it out of the corner of my eye, and it registered as a pen. In zero gravity, things will drift out of pockets and float off. There's no way of keeping anything in place unless it is physically confined. You expect pens and coins and anything else that can find an opening to drift their way through the opening eventually and go wherever air currents and inertia lead them. So my mind registered pen, and I groped for it absently. And, of course, my fingers didn't close on it. Just reaching for something sets up an air current that pushes it away. You have to reach over it and sneak behind it with one hand, and then reach for it with the other. Picking up any small object in midair is a two-hand operation. I know some people can do it one-handed, but they're space hounds and I'm not. I turned to look at the object and pay a little more attention to retrieval, then realized that my pen was safely in its pouch. I felt for it, and it was there. "Did you lose a pen, Joe?" I called out.
"No."
"Anything like that? Key? Cigarette?" "I don't smoke. You know that." A stupid answer. "Anything," I said in exasperation. "I'm seeing things here." "No one ever said you were stable."
"Look, Joe, over there, over there."
He lunged for it. I could have told him it would do no good. By now, though, our poking around in the computer seemed to have stirred things up. We were seeing them wherever we looked. They were floating in the air current. I stopped one at last. Or, rather, it stopped itself, for it was on the elbow of Joe's suit. I snatched it off and shouted. Joe jumped in terror and nearly knocked it out of my hand. I said, "Look." There was a shiny circle on Joe's suit where I had taken the thing off. It had begun to eat its way through. "Give it to me," said Joe. He took it gingerly and put it against the wall to hold it steady. Then he shelled it, gently lifting the paper-thin metal. There was something inside that looked like a line of cigarette ash. It caught the light and glinted, though, like lightly woven metal. There was a moistness about it, too. It wriggled slowly, one end seeming to seek something blindly. The end made contact with the wall and stuck. Joe's finger pushed it away. It seemed to require a small effort to do so. Joe rubbed his finger and thumb and said, "Feels oily." The metal worm, I don't know what else I can call it, seemed limp now after Joe had touched it. It didn't move again. I was twisting and turning, trying to look at myself. "Joe," I said, "for heaven's sake, have I got one of them on me anywhere?" "I don't see one," he said. "Well, look at me. You've got to watch me, Joe, and I'll watch you. If our suits are wrecked, we might not be able to get back to the ship." Joe said, "Keep moving, then." It was a grisly feeling being surrounded by things hungry to dissolve your suit wherever they could touch it. When any showed up, we tried to catch them and stay out of their way at the same time, which made things almost impossible. A rather long one drifted close to my leg and I kicked at it, which was stupid, for if I had hit it, it might have stuck. As it was, the air current I set up brought it against the wall where it stayed. Joe reached hastily for it, too hastily. The rest of his body rebounded, and as he somersaulted, one booted foot struck the wall near the cylinder lightly. When he finally managed to right himself, it was still there. "I didn't smash it, did I?" "No, you didn't," I said. "You missed it by a decimeter. It won't get away." I had a hand on either side of it. It was twice as long as the other cylinder had been. In fact, it was like two cylinders stuck together lengthwise, with a constriction at the point of joining. "Act of reproducing," said Joe, as he peeled away the metal. This time what was inside was a line of dust. In space till they find something appropriate in which they can multiply. They look for sizable objects, ready-made of metal. I don't imagine they can smelt ores. But large metal objects with pure silicon components and a few other succulent matters, like that, are the products of intelligent life only, I said. "Right," said Joe. "Which means we have the best evidence yet that intelligent life is common in the universe, since objects like the one we're on must be quite common, or it couldn't support these viruses. And it means that intelligent life is old, too, perhaps 10 billion years old, long enough for a kind of metal evolution, forming a metal-silicon oil life, as we have formed a nucleic protein water life. Time to evolve a parasite on space-age artifacts." I said, "You make it sound as though every time some intelligent life form develops a space culture, it is subjected before long to parasitic infestation." "Right. And it must be controlled. Fortunately, these things are easy to kill, especially now when they're forming. Later on, when they're ready to burrow out of computer 2, I suppose they will grow, thicken their shells, stabilize their interior, and prepare as the equivalent of spores to drift a million years before they find another home. They might not be so easy to kill then. How are you going to kill them? I already have. I just touched the first one when it instinctively sought out metal to begin manufacturing a new shell after I had broken open the first one, and that touch finished it. I didn't touch the second, but I kicked the wall near it, and the sound vibration in the metal shook its interior apart into metal dust. So they can't get us now, or any more of the computer, if we just shake them apart now. He didn't have to explain further, or as much. He put on his gauntlets slowly, and then banged at the wall with one. It pushed him away, and he kicked at the wall where he next approached it. "You do the same," he shouted. I tried to, and for a while we both kept at it. You don't know how hard it is to hit a wall at zero gravity, at least on purpose, and do it hard enough to make it clang. We missed as often as not, or just struck it a glancing blow that sent us whirling, but made virtually no sound. We were panting with effort and aggravation in no time. But we had acclimated ourselves, or at least I had, and the nausea didn't return. We kept it up, and then when we gathered up some more of the viruses, there was nothing inside but dust in every case. They were clearly adapted to empty, automated space objects which, like modern computers, were vibration-free. That's what made it possible, I suppose, to build up the exceedingly rickety, complex metallic structures that possessed sufficient instability to produce the properties of simple life. I said, "Do you think we got them all, Joe?" "How can I say? If there's one left, it will cannibalize the others for metal supplies and start all over. Let's bang around some more." We did, until we were sufficiently worn out not to care whether one was still left alive. "Of course," I said, panting, "the Planetary Association for the Advancement of Science isn't going to be pleased with our killing them all." Joe's suggestion as to what the PAAS could do with itself was forceful, but impractical. He said, "Look, our mission is to save Computer 2, a few thousand lives, and, as it turned out, our own lives, too. Now they can decide whether to renovate this computer or rebuild it from scratch. It's their baby. The PAAS can get what they can out of these dead objects, and that should be something. If they want live ones, I suspect they'll find them floating about in these regions. They can look for them if they want live specimens, but they'd better watch their suits at all times. I don't think they can vibrate them to death in open space." I said, "All right. My suggestion is we tell Computer Central we're going to jerry-rig this computer and get it doing some work anyway. And we'll stay till the relief is up for main repairs or whatever in order to prevent any reinfestation. Meanwhile, they better get to each of the other computers and set up a system that can set it to vibrating strongly as soon as the internal atmosphere shows a pressure drop." "Simple enough," said Joe sardonically. "It's lucky we found them when we did." "Wait a while," said Joe, and the look in his eye was one of deep trouble. "We didn't find them. They found us. If metal life has developed, do you suppose it's likely that this is the only form it takes? Just this fragile kind? What if such life forms communicate somehow and, across the vastness of space, others are now converging on us for the picking? Other species, too. All of them after the lush new fodder of an as-yet untouched space culture. Other species. Some that are sturdy enough to withstand vibration. Some that are large enough to be more versatile in their reactions to danger. Some that are equipped to invade our settlements in orbit. Some, for the sake of UNIVAC, that may be able to invade the Earth for the metals of its cities. What I'm going to report, what I must report, is that we've been